Hello and welcome to Military History Inside Out. In today's episode, I speak with Randall Fowler about his new book on the Eisenhower Doctrine, how Eisenhower wanted to convince the American people and also the Middle East that the U.S. should and would be protecting the Middle East against the incursion of communism. So Randall and I speak about that subject, about obviously the history of that period, the Middle East in that time, and how the various players, including the U.S., the Soviet Union, the United Kingdom, and of course the Middle Eastern countries themselves, how they dealt with the Eisenhower Doctrine. So thank you and enjoy. I'm speaking with Randall Fowler, author of More Than a Doctrine, The Eisenhower Era in the Middle East. Thank you for speaking with me.
Thanks for having me.
So first, I'd like to start by asking what your background is in writing and in history.
Yeah, so, my background in history starts with my undergraduate degree. I was a religious studies history major, so I studied the history of Christianity and Islam originally. But my interest specifically in writing and writing academically began during the time I spent in Jordan. So 2013-2014, I was a Fulbright grantee to Jordan and taught English over there. And so during that time, I got a lot more interested in academic writing and academic history and ways to understand the Middle East specifically. So since then, more or less, I've been writing on topics of Middle East, America's role in the Middle East, and how we can understand that role through rhetorical historical lenses. So really, I got interested in Middle East history, gosh, I guess about 10 years ago. I, of all things, went on a baseball trip to Israel. So there's an organization I was partnering with that was doing a baseball camp for kids from Haifa. And so went over to the Middle East for the first time. It was very eye-opening for me. And so at that point, I really got interested not only in the history of, you know, Israel and the Middle East generally, the Arab-Israeli conflict, but also, you know, my role as an American, you know, where do we fit into the story? And so really since then, I've been interested in issues of what is America's role in the Middle East and how do we represent that to the American public.
Have you always wanted to write a book on this particular subject?
Not really. So this subject, the book, kind of started as a smaller research project looking specifically at the Suez Crisis during my first couple years of graduate school. So I was looking at Suez from the lens of how did President Eisenhower represent America's role here, because we do not side with our traditional allies, Britain, France, Israel. Instead, we side with the Arabs, specifically Nasser and Egypt, to not back them, and instead, you know, we basically embarrass our allies and settle on that side. So, as a result of that, I'm interested more in. As a result of that, I really started to dig into the Eisenhower administration, started to learn about why did we make that decision, what was going on in terms of American defense planning. How did Eisenhower represent those to the public? So really the personal thrust for this is not so much academic, but my interest in the Middle East, my time over there in Israel, my time in Jordan, my time in a few other countries over there. But academically speaking, the project started mostly as a look at the Suez Crisis and expanded from there.
Okay. So tell me a little bit about this book.
Yeah, so More Than a Doctrine specifically looked at the Eisenhower Doctrine. So I am a rhetorician by training. I look at history through a rhetorical lens. So what that means is I'm interested in how do actors in history use rhetoric to create argument structures that then reverberate throughout sort of the historical narrative and impact us today. So the argument for More Than a Doctrine is that the Eisenhower Doctrine address was given on January 5th, 1957, by Eisenhower, fundamentally changed America's relationship to the Middle East. During that speech, Eisenhower announces that the U.S. will support any ally that's willing to reject communism, come out publicly against the USSR and against their perceived allies in the region. He says that we effectively write a blank check to those countries, that we're going to defend them with whatever means necessary. And in that speech, that was the first time a president had really said, this is what we're willing to do in the Middle East. We are the dominant power. We will do whatever is necessary to keep communism out of here. So what the book tries to do is look at that speech, analyze it. Why did Eisenhower say, this is what we're going to do? Why did he use the strategies he used to try to convince Congress to pass a joint resolution in defense of his measure? He effectively asked them to give him the authority to use military troops without congressional authorization. He also tried to create a narrative for the American public to say, this is who we are in the region. We have a threat, Soviet Union. We have friends, Arab countries, Israel, and we need to step in to defend them from this threat. And so he creates these structures that I think are important, but really what the book looks at is, why did we do that at this point? It had been 12 years since World War II. It had been some time since we had really started thinking about the Middle East in terms of we might go to war over this region with the Soviet Union. Why then? And so that's what the book tries to explain, looking at about 8 years of the Eisenhower presidency, starting in 1952 and then going through 60.
So who was involved in developing this doctrine and actually helping him write this speech?
Yeah, so Eisenhower had several speech writers. Whenever I was looking at the archives, it went through, I think, 17 drafts off the top of my head, but I think that's about right. And so John Foster Dulles had a hand, the Secretary of State at the time, had a hand in helping draft it. Eisenhower obviously had a major role in it. But it circulated throughout different different drafts. They took out different parts, specifically talking about the way in which Britain and France had been weakened. They essentially omitted anything referencing Britain and France. My argument is that the reason they did that was because the speech came on the heels of the Suez Crisis. That event effectively discredited Britain and France from running the regional power structure. You know, they were intervening in Egypt, trying to overthrow a government using military force. That is a strategy calling back to 19th century imperialist warfare, as I'm sure you're aware. And so as a result of that, you know, Eisenhower, the previous speech manuscripts take that part out, and they mostly play up the threat, play up America's role in needing to be the sole actor that can meet this this threat that's, you know, the communism viewed as a monolith that might overwhelm the Middle East. So specifically, I don't know who wrote each aspect of the speech. In the archives, it just says draft number. It doesn't say who the author specifically was, and that's pretty typical for presidential rhetoric.
So, you know, this period and region is still, you know, somewhat mysterious to me. It's not something I've studied a lot. So, but one thing it makes me wonder, and that you alluded to, is that, you know, it's shifting more from sort of an imperialist idea, you know, with the Europeans being involved, to the U.S. being a guarantor of freedom, or, you know, resistance against communism, but for whose sake in that region?
Yeah, that's a good question. So starting in World War II, you have American defense planners start talking about the Middle East as this region of critical importance. The main reason for that is oil. Tankers that can travel around the Cape of Africa effectively to deliver oil aren't really on the scene until the 1960s. You know, we're talking 100,000 ton tankers. And so because of that, it's infeasible for the United States to really ship oil worldwide. And as a result of that, you know, Middle Eastern oil is really critical to Europe. Obviously, the winter of 1947 destabilized massive amounts of the European economy. You can read some of the accounts of that winter in Britain, just how devastating it was, locking up lots of the infrastructure. So what you have is a situation where oil is critical for Europe. In United States defense planning, you know, Europe is critical to stopping the Soviet Union. We have the NATO alliance that eventually gets established. But the idea here is, in order for our global defense to work, we have to have Europe up and running. In order to have Europe up and running, we need to have the Middle East up and running. And so this type of thinking permeates U.S. defense planning really from the 1940s on. The question is, whose role is it to make sure the Middle East is effectively on America's side? And so leading up to, you know, the Eisenhower administration, this is a region that's been dominated by Britain since World War I. France controls Syria. Nominally, after World War II, they get their independence pretty quickly. But Britain is still pretty much in control of large parts of Iran. They control the oil plant at Abadan, which at that point was the world's leading oil refinery in the world. They control Iraq. They control Palestine. They control Egypt. And so the British are really the main power in the region. So leading up to the Eisenhower administration, you have a situation where Britain is a declining power. After World War II, they're spent. You have decolonization, in, you know, taking place worldwide. India leaves British control in 1947. They're trying to put together the Commonwealth during this period. And so as a result, you see American defense planners saying, we need to step in. We're going to plan our military doctrine, our national security directives, in such a way that we are willing to go to war if, say, the Soviet Union invades Iran or if Turkey gets attacked or something like that. At the same time, you have this sort of public face where Britain is the major power in the region. It's Britain's responsibility. Americans don't really need to concern ourselves with that part of the world. It's important, but it's not necessarily our job to defend that area of the world from the perceived communist aggression. And so that's the situation leading into the Eisenhower administration is how can Eisenhower or should Eisenhower reconcile those two stances? The public face of this is not our problem to the private stance that we're willing to go to World War III over this region.
So from what you described, the Middle East was a vital component of U.S. security. Did it mean as much to the Soviets, you know, as far as, was it worth trying to do everything to take over in order to totally weaken the U.S., led security structure, or, you know, what was their take, if you can address that?
Yeah. So, Soviets, obviously, later in the Eisenhower administration, you have Nikita Khrushchev, who does a really good job, from a Soviet perspective of promoting, you know, anti-imperialism and trying to, you know, start revolutions across the world against the British and French and by implication, the American, security structure. But before then, under Stalin, what you have is 1944, in Iran. So Iran during World War II, effectively get split in two between the British and Soviets. So their Shah had flirted a little bit with the Nazis. And because of that, also in order to make sure that the oil plant stayed firmly in Allied control, and also to make sure that American lend-lease equipment could make its way to Russia through the southern port there on the Persian Gulf, the British and Soviets take over Persia effectively. I think that's called Operation Countenance. And that took place in 1941. And so from 44 or 42 onwards, you have the United States, Britain, and Russia sort of policing Iran. In 1944, the Soviets start a major diplomatic row over an American oil concession that's given in northern Iran. So early on, even during World War II, you see the Russians starting to position themselves, the Soviets trying to sort of set themselves up for after World War II being in a position, at least relative to Iran, to making major inroads into what had previously been a British region of control. 1946, the Soviets invade the Azerbaijani provinces of Iran near Tehran, or not near Tehran, near Tabriz, up in the northwest of Iran. And so the Soviets tried to pinch off two provinces effectively and add it to the USSR, and a lot of protests and diplomatic wrangling and George Kennan going over the street and delivering a handwritten letter to Molotov, the Soviet foreign minister, effectively worked to stop that. But you see the Soviets trying to get into Iran. You see the Soviets trying to work several different angles in terms of intelligence. to break into the Middle East. Their big breakthrough happens in Egypt. So over the course of the book, I talk about this, but they were able to effectively parlay Egyptian discontent with the British and Americans into sort of adding Cairo to their orbit. So during 1953 to 1955, we dispatch a lot of CIA advisors. We have lots of personnel working in Egypt, advising the new regime there. They overthrew their monarchy in 1951. And then after this period, we don't give them the grant for the Aswan High Dam. We're frustrated with Cairo because they recognize communist China rather than Formosa, the Republic of China under Chiang Kai-shek. And so because of that, they get mad at us. They receive a massive arms deal from the Soviet Union. And at that point, the Soviets have what the commentators at the time called overstepped containment. So through these arms shipments, they have effectively broken into the Middle East. And so a lot of the Eisenhower administration and a lot of the story that I tell throughout the book is how did Eisenhower deal with that? Because Nasser wasn't necessarily a Soviet stooge. He's very much an independent actor, but he is friendly with the Soviets. And so it was a question of how did we as America sort of deal with that inroad that the Soviets made?
So how much did Eisenhower, in the doctrine and in his actions, emphasize religion, versus the godless communists? You know, did he make that an issue? Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So so one thing that Eisenhower does, I think the quote is attributed to him, I deeply believe that America needs to have a faith, a deep and abiding faith or something like that, and I don't care what it is. So he was very conscious of the fact that the Middle East was a religious area of the world, although at this time secularism is really popular. Arab nationalism is kind of in vogue, and Arab nationalism is more of a secular ideology, more so than some of the ones that predominate today that we find ourselves on the other side from. During that period, so Eisenhower constantly makes these references to the Holy Land, the land of Islam, the land of Christianity and Judaism, and how all three of us, you know, Muslims, Christians, and Jews, should be on one side opposed to those godless atheists, the communists. And so that's specifically a line in the Eisenhower Doctrine address. One of the rationales he gives for increased American presence in the region was to defend the Holy Land, this region of the world that matters, the Abrahamic faiths, from atheists. And so that's a line there, and I argued that, and he's kind of, like it's folded into his larger project of dualism, where, you know, where everything that's good and free and right is on one side, and everything that's bad and terrible and oppressive is on the other side. And Eisenhower consistently used dualism throughout his foreign policy rhetoric.
It's interesting to compare that, compare and contrast that attitude to the attitude now, you know, where it's not a unity of religion. It's, you know, division. It creates division in a sense.
Oh, certainly. Yeah. Well, it's interesting, especially the way that Islam gets talked about in American presidential discourse now. Obviously, Trump has all sorts of baggage and there are all sorts of frameworks that people take to interpret what he says. But Obama as well, I think there's this kind of interesting tension between wanting to say, sort of along with Eisenhower, we're all sort of people of faith and all come alongside each other, and even people without faith can appreciate, you know, Jerusalem and the Abrahamic religions and all the good that they've done in the world. At the same time, you also have this obvious current of, you know, the United States is at war with Al-Qaeda and ISIS and you know, radical Islamist ideologies or whatever you want to call them. And so that's kind of an interesting tension in our current discourse today, I think.
Was there a period from the establishment of the doctrine, was there a period when it sort of just kind of died as an idea, or at least went into hibernation for a while?
So the Eisenhower Doctrine, yeah. So as a policy, it really failed. You know, no Arab leaders were willing to publicly stake themselves to the United States that closely. primarily because Nasser, again in Egypt, the promoter of Arab nationalism, which is this idea of pan-Arab solidarity, if the Arab nation can come together under one state, supposedly, then the Arabs will be unstoppable. It's this idea that Arabs have been kept down by the colonialist powers. They were kept down by the Turks before that. But eventually, if they're able to unite, they'll be able to become a major world power. And so Nasser is promoting this idea, and it has very deep anti-American, anti-British, anti-French overtones at the time of the Eisenhower Doctrine's utterance. And so because of that, no Arab leader of consequence really ties himself that closely to the United States by effectively taking Eisenhower up on his offer. And so what's interesting is you have a few smaller leaders. One of those is Kamil Shamoun, who was in charge of or held major position in Lebanon. And 18 months after the Eisenhower Doctrine address was given, Eisenhower invokes the Eisenhower Doctrine after it had been abandoned as a policy, really, to defend Shamoun from Arab nationalist rebels, effectively, who were trying to take over Lebanon and take him out, even though he was trying to illegally maintain power after his term had expired. So I dive into that complexity a little bit in the book, but what I think is interesting isn't so much the policy of saying we're going to back our friends, we'll extend whatever military aid or economic aid we can. What I think is interesting is, obviously as a rhetorician, here we see for the first time a really robust defense of America's presence in the Middle East. And really for reasons that aren't totally above the table in terms of what people are aware of, what preceded that speech and what immediately came after it. And so one of the undertones, I think, of the book is I think a lot of our public discourse about the Middle East now in the United States is pretty muddled. We tend to talk past each other. We tend to not necessarily understand why the constellations of, political allegiance or different arguments sort of link together. And what the book tries to show, I think, is that that's effectively how it's been at the start. We've been in the Middle East for reasons that had a lot to do with the Cold War, that had a lot to do with preventing the Soviets from being there. Those reasons weren't fully articulated all the time, weren't necessarily defended, frankly. And so because of that, there are effects today.
Yeah, it's. I'm trying to formulate questions, but as I think through everything, it's just so confusing that it's almost it's difficult to figure out where to continue asking questions, because the Middle East is such a mix of so many different tribes and attitudes and political systems and languages and whatnot, and it's
So I think that complexity. I think you're right. I think that is a common attitude that we have. I actually comment, I think the book opener alludes to Jon Stewart. I don't know if you ever watched The Daily Show, but while he was on The Daily Show, he had his bit Mesopotamia. And he always talked about, the American war in Iraq, and obviously he's taking a very critical eye to our intervention there. But I think there's this idea consistently in American public discourse about the Middle East that it is this really complex place, that there is a lot of stuff going on, and so we just tend to sort of flatten it down to this issue or that issue. I think earlier this week we saw the death of 60 or so Gazan Palestinians at the hands of Israeli defense forces. Regardless of whether you're pro-Israel or pro-Palestine or where you land in that, what's really interesting is that people immediately flock to their tribe, right, in terms of saying, well, Israel has a right to self-defense, or the Gazans are just trying to live not in an open-air prison. You see these sort of refrains get repeated. And so we have this tendency to reduce. I think we have this tendency to want to make the complex simpler because that's what works in political discourse. Saying, I'm yet to see the presidential candidate who gets elected on the platform of nuance, right? And so I think Eisenhower does that too. And presidents preceding him do that as well. One of the arguments I make in the book is that Woodrow Wilson's really the first president to really talk about the Middle East at all. And what he does is he basically frames it as an issue of, A, this is a British area of responsibility. We don't need to worry about it. And B, we're friends of Zionists. We're going to support the Zionist project to populate Palestine with Jewish settlers. And eventually, you know, that culminates with the establishment of Israel. So I think you're right. I think there's this tendency to be a little bit bewildered by the complexity of the region. And I think that that's something that is in part a legacy of perhaps Eisenhower, and that he really did use these very reductive frames of, you know, this region is free. It's not communist. This region is religious, not atheist. This region is, you know, allied with us, not with them. When in reality, there were a lot of complex cross currents going on, both then and now.
Did he define the Middle East then the way we define it now, or were there other regions he wouldn't have considered, or, you know, or did that we wouldn't now?
Yeah, so Eisenhower uses the term Mideast a lot. I think roughly it's kind of analogous. In terms of the specific administrative structures, the Middle East fell under the Undersecretary for the Near East and Africa for most of the Eisenhower administration in terms of the diplomatic responsibility. So I think Near East is used a lot. Near East kind of has a more, you know, Iran at the farthest east, certainly, tone. Turkey also sort of plays into that as well.
How much of North Africa would he have considered? I mean, it's obviously not the Mideast, but people just, yeah, for, you know, people like to lump it in.
Yeah, I think, you know, really I take as my focus, you know, the Middle East. I kind of consider Egypt as the boundary there. So I'm talking about maybe the core of the Middle East. That might be a more helpful term. You know, Eisenhower does talk about things that go on in Morocco specifically and other parts of kind of the greater region. But I would argue that, you know, he's probably not thinking Afghanistan. He's definitely not thinking Pakistan or India, except insofar as, you know, regional defense broadly defined. One thing that happens under Eisenhower is the attempt to organize a regional defense alliance. So you have the North Atlantic Treaty Organization that's established pretty early on, NATO. You have CETO, the Southeast Asian Treaty Organization that's established. And there's this attempt to do something similar in the Middle East that sort of goes off and on throughout the Eisenhower administration. And so one of the plans to do that was called MEDO, Middle East Defense Organization. And the idea for that was going to include Pakistan and India. But, you know, obviously the, you know, regional regional definitions kind of vary. So it is interesting, you know, for the purposes of building an alliance, we're more than willing to include Pakistan. But in terms of policy, it mostly falls under Near Eastern and so therefore Arab world, Arabic speaking world, not so much, you know, Farsi or Urdu or Pashto or anything over there.
I think one of the big themes in the Middle East, which I'm not sure how well the U.S. understood it, is the, you know, Persia versus Arabia thing.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Did the U.S. recognize that tension, or how is that addressed?
Yeah, so that's an interesting kind of trilateral relationship there. So really, Iran is kind of the anchor point for American defense of the Middle East for most of the Cold War until the revolution. So until the Iranian Revolution in 1979. Mm-hmm. So right now, obviously, Iran and Saudi Arabia are at each other's throats. But it's interesting that there was a little bit of a rivalry there, but it wasn't anywhere near as pronounced as it is today, partly because a lot of the oil reserves in Saudi Arabia weren't fully being exploited until really the late 50s, 60s, 70s. That's whenever Saudi Arabia really starts to take off. But especially whenever American defense planners are thinking of, you know, where do we need to station our troops? Where do we need to be ready to intervene? Iran is hands down kind of the center point of that. That also gets reflected later in the Cold War. You know, Nixon, under his Vietnamization policy, really opens up American arms transfers. This is something else that I've researched. He really opens up American arms exports, and I think we saw $16 billion of sales, which at that point was, you know, vastly more than had ever been sold before, between Nixon and the incoming Reagan administration, kind of in between late Nixon, Ford, Carter, and half of that went to Iran. So half of all U.S. arms exports really during most of the 70s went to Iran. So for a long time, you have Iran that kind of centers – in American defense planners' thinking, which is one reason why I think the coup occurs in 1953. And there's a chapter in the book about that as well, Operation Ajax, which I'm sure you're familiar with, and you know, MI6, CIA coup to restore the Shah to power there. And so a few other cross currents certainly were going on, though. One subject that's talked about a lot in political science literature is the Arab Cold War. So Egypt had a big rivalry going on with Saudi Arabia. Obviously, Saudi Arabia is a very traditionalist monarchy. I don't think they had more than a dozen TV sets in the country, actually, until the 1960s. Mm-hmm. So they have, you know, not a lot of, you know, Western influence, not a lot of stuff there. And so it's very much a traditionalist monarchy versus Cairo, which under Gamal Abdel Nasser, who, as I mentioned, was effectively the dictator, military dictator of Egypt during this period. He's, you know, secular, he's very modern, he's very cutting edge. He uses all sorts of propaganda techniques. He has a radio show called Voice of the Arabs that broadcasts across the Middle East. And that was an interesting rivalry then, was Cairo versus Riyadh. And you have different countries that sort of fall in different spots there. But yeah, it is interesting to see those shift, I think, the different, not major power rivalries, but perhaps regional power rivalries, how those sort of change from time to time.
So I want to address rhetoric again. Did the Eisenhower Doctrine, did American rhetoric translate well or properly to Middle Easterners? Did they understand the message being sent, and, you know, whatever opinions they have on it? Did they understand what he was saying?
Yeah, so I think, you know, obviously there's a translation issue there. But one thing that does happen under Eisenhower is a much better awareness that popular sentiment matters. So another theme in the book that I kind of address is this idea of, you know, Eisenhower and Khrushchev, to an extent, you know, they're the chief diplomats of communism and capitalism and the free world versus the Soviet world. Mm-hmm. And both of them are sort of functioning as representatives of these larger systems. And during this era of decolonization, there's a really big open question as to what type of governments are going to emerge in these, you know, formerly colonized regions. Eisenhower, in several letters and in a few dispatches that I quote in the book, repeatedly says, you know, he's very thankful that the United States was not a major imperialist power or colonial power, because that helps the United States, you know, effectively sell itself to a lot of the people in the Middle East and the Third World overall, as it was called then. So one thing that I think occurs is, you know, the United States is not popular in the Arab world at all. Most of that, then as now, most of that derives from American support for Israel, then as now. But Eisenhower, more than maybe any president since, was very attuned to the fact that the United States needed to come across as a neutral arbiter between Israel and the Arabs. And so because of that, he very much put a lot of daylight between the United States and Israel. And so that comes out clearly during the Suez Crisis, when we, you know, effectively chastise Israel and threatened to censor private donations to Israel. So any American that wanted to donate privately to Israel, he was going to prevent that from happening. Threatened to do that, threatened to withhold currency, all sorts of different measures he was willing to take against Israel. So Eisenhower tried to take steps to address sort of the popularity gap between, you know, anti-imperialist Soviet Union Khrushchev, who's, you know, railing against Western powers meddling in regions of the world where they're not wanted, and the United States, which is, you know, from Eisenhower's perspective in the Middle East, unfortunately allied to those very powers. And he took measures to address it, but really, I don't think they were very effective overall. It did work to keep leaders on our side, though. And that's kind of another pattern you see happening with American politics in the Middle East, is even though, you know, American policy might be broadly unpopular, we are very close to the leaders. I think you see that with a lot of countries today still.
You mentioned something that made me consider an interesting issue. You know, you said, you know, basically it was, you know, Soviets versus the U.S., but in a sense, U.S. democracy was a rival to European imperialism. You know, like, I know France and, yeah. and Britain were declining, but if you're one of their governments and you're looking at the U.S. pushing democracy, that weakens your position as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly. And the British and French, you know, the French really aren't major players in the Middle East during the time I'm talking about. Really, they are very consumed with the Algerian War. So during kind of the mid-50s, I forget the exact start date for that, into the early 60s, you know, Algeria is fighting this very, very bloody civil war, or what the French called a civil war, what the Algerians called a war of independence, against France, you know. And so France is really spending a lot of its energy there, as well as in French Indochina, which obviously metastasizes into the Vietnam War, which is a whole other story.
Hmm.
But, you know, the French really aren't a major player, but they do resent, you know, the Americans sort of moving in, as the French are apt to do. And the British are very much aware of the fact that the United States is trying to displace them in the region. And so they're a bit frustrated. There's a few quotes that I kind of throw in there from British diplomats in Iraq and in Egypt. There's actually a story in Egypt about how there was this private club that a lot of the spies would meet at, whether MI6 or CIA or something else, or Israeli Mossad. And so they would meet in this cafe, and that was kind of where they would talk to their Egyptian counterpart. And the British were really frustrated because the Americans got better seats than they did. And so it's these, you know, obviously, you know, the United States and the European powers are going to remain allies during the Cold War. Britain is still the world's third largest economy during this period. So the United States is absolutely not going to forsake its relationship with Britain or with France for the sake of another country. But there is this attempt on the part of the U.S. diplomatic corps and spies and the presidential administration even to try to make a distinction between, okay, these are our allies, Britain and France, the Europeans. They aren't us. You know, we are, you know, true democracy. We are real representatives of freedom. We're real representatives of justice. We're the ones you should model yourself after and be friends with. And so that's kind of an interesting, interesting rivalry that kind of takes place during this period.
Yeah, and I ask because I think people looking at history always presume, well, it was East versus West even back then. But I feel like there were more sides than people realize, more interests being fought over.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Well, and one thing, you know, this history, if you go and read, you know, the real thick history about this period, it's wildly complex, right? You have, even just with one, in the course of a week, you'll have, you know, the different exchanges and cables going on between different diplomatic headquarters and all sorts of different positions that are being taken, you know, even regarding the Baghdad Pact, which was an alliance between a few countries in the Middle East. I think it was Iran, Iraq, Turkey, Pakistan, and Britain during this period. You know, there's still a raging debate by historians of the era over whether the current or the Secretary of State at the time, John Foster Dulles, if he wanted to be a part of that or if he wanted to keep the U.S. out of it, or if he did want to keep the U.S. out of it, why and who was trying to position, you know, underneath him, you know, this infighting within the State Department. And I think it's really complex if you look really close enough. And that's hopefully something that people get out of the book and people, you know, really when you study history, you realize just how complex it is. It's not just East versus West. Not just, you know, America and friends versus the Soviet Union and friends. You have all these different cross currents going on. And so the book tries to not get lost in the weeds with all that. Mm-hmm. But I do, you know, kind of nod to those complexities and at a few times just sort of try to tie it off and say, hey, there's a debate around this. But this is what Eisenhower did and said.
So there was one major military issue that arose in October 1957, which is Sputnik going up, and U.S. fears that, you know, that would be nuclear missiles in space. Did the Middle East thing, as far as getting territory to put nuclear missiles on, was that an issue or something being thought about in this period?
Yeah, so during this period, you have American nuclear missiles positioned in Turkey, which obviously that is a major factor leading up to the Cuban Missile Crisis that takes place under Kennedy right after Eisenhower leaves office. So those are installed, I think, during the Eisenhower administration. I'm not an expert on ballistic missile and nuclear technology, but I'm pretty sure those get placed and developed and beefed up a lot during the Eisenhower administration. That's going on in Turkey. And in regards to Sputnik specifically, I don't think it made a major impact in regards to Middle East policy, except to perhaps heighten American fears that the Soviet Union might be overtaking the United States both diplomatically and or not diplomatically, technologically, and in regards to, this is a new theater of Cold War, right? Space. So that sort of heightens the need to make sure that American defense posture is as robust as possible. And so that's happening right leading up to the Eisenhower Doctrine address and right after. Obviously, that's kind of the context of the era.
Would you say, can you even differentiate between the importance between the Middle East being its proximity to the Soviet Union versus the fact that the oil was so important? Let's say the oil was in, South America. Would the Middle East have been just like, whatever, let the Soviets have it kind of attitude, or,
Yeah, maybe more so. I think obviously domino theory really predominates during this time. So domino theory being the idea that, if the Soviet Union or communism is really the term that gets bandied about. So if the communists are able to take over one country, say Iran or Korea or Vietnam, that's one domino to fall that could lead to another domino falling, say Malaysia or Japan, or in the case of the Middle East, maybe Iraq or Jordan or Saudi Arabia. The idea that, if any domino falls, we can't allow one domino to fall, and thereby, if we can keep all countries non-communist that are currently non-communist, we can prevent any outbreak. And so that's sort of the guiding defensive posture and theory going on during the Eisenhower administration. But in terms of oil, I think the reason the Middle East is so critical is because it's the main source for Europe. And that has to do with proximity. So the North Sea oil fields also aren't discovered until the 1950s. And so Europe really has no domestic sources of oil. Again, tanker technology is not that great at this point, and so it would be really difficult for the United States, which at the time is a major oil exporter, to really supply Europe with all of its energy demand. And so that's why the Middle East is critically important to American defense thinkers is, the Soviet Union has plenty of oil supplies. They can provide aid to all their allies, but if all of a sudden the Middle East falls under communist sway, snap of a finger, Soviet Union cuts off trade relations with Europe, the European economy collapses. Mm-hmm. And if the European economy collapses, all of a sudden it becomes much more difficult for the United States to maintain NATO, to maintain a robust defensive posture vis-a-vis the Soviet Union. And you also have, Eisenhower is a Republican, right? He's an old school Republican, very concerned about fiscal health. In fact, in his speech opening his campaign, he identifies one of the threats facing the United States as too much defense spending, and wasteful defense spending under Truman. And so one thing that he does is he tries to shift to a policy of asymmetric response. So the idea being, if the Soviet Union starts something somewhere, we aren't going to respond symmetrically. If they send, 12 divisions into, say Pakistan, we aren't going to respond symmetrically by sending our own 12 divisions or 13 divisions. We're going to respond asymmetrically with the Strategic Bombing Corps, with our nuclear advantage. We're effectively going to start a nuclear war over any conventional incursion. And so part of this is also the subtext of the United States really needs its allies. It really needs manpower. It really needs their standing armies in order to supplement, Eisenhower's goal for an American defense posture that is both robust and, not fiscally draining on the U.S. economy. So, that's another theme that kind of permeates the Eisenhower administration and during this time in the Middle East is we don't just need the region for its oil. We also need the region because, the Iranian army and the Turkish army and the Pakistani army are perceived as necessary to potentially hem in the Soviet Union.
That's an amazing thing you just said, because I feel like now we're 180 degrees from that, where our adversaries spend a tiny bit and we end up spending tens, hundreds of times that amount to defend.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, no, it is really interesting when you look at it now, especially, you know, obviously terrorism or guerrilla warfare as a strategy, combat. Yeah, I mean, it is very much the inverse. We end up spending a lot of money to prosecute our wars nowadays. And you know, that's a really complex, complex thing that I don't, you know, have the slightest grasp of where all that money goes. But I do think that, at least during this era, when it's really thought of as state versus state conflict, Eisenhower is very concerned to make the Cold War sustainable. That's one term he uses a lot. And he's really afraid of the U.S. becoming, it is a term he also uses a lot, a garrison state. You know, he says our economy is healthy enough, we're rich enough in order to pay a large army to maintain conventional forces, but he doesn't want the effect that would have on American civil society to have a large standing army. And you know, that harkens back to really ancient, or not ancient, but longstanding, you know, tropes within American public discourse, this idea that we don't need a standing army like the Europeans did during the Age of Imperialism, that we're a free country with free people, and we don't need to have a large standing army because that's a threat to liberty. And we have come quite a ways from both that era and the Eisenhower era in regards to our norms regarding American military deployment and spending, that's for sure.
Yeah. So what resources did you use for your research?
Yeah, so a lot of the archival documents I came across were from the Eisenhower Library in Abilene, Kansas. So I'm actually a native of Abilene, Texas, which was no small source of entertainment to the lovely folks in Kansas whenever I showed up there. But I mostly used looking at national security briefing papers, looking at cables between John Foster Dulles and Eisenhower, or Eisenhower and other foreign leaders, looking at speeches by Eisenhower. So one of the nice things about the library up there is that they have all the speech drafts as well as the actual speeches. So UCSB.presidency, I think .edu, or it might be .org, the American Presidency Project has every utterance of an American president stored digitally on that website. But in terms of the drafts, in terms of kind of what's going on behind the scenes, I mostly relied on the Eisenhower Library. So I looked at that. I also looked at memoirs, looked at diaries, looked at briefing papers. One interesting thing was that Eisenhower was very sure to not leave a paper trail regarding his briefings on covert activity that the United States performed in the Middle East during that period. So it'll say, you know, CIA Director Allen Dulles gave an oral briefing to National Security Council, period. And so you know that that's about other things, but Eisenhower doesn't leave a paper trail.
Do you do any interviews?
No, I did not do any interviews, since this is mostly, you know, looking at the 50s specifically. I did rely on a few oral interviews that other people had done, that the Eisenhower Library still had, had on file up there. So listened to several interviews of Eisenhower, of Allen Dulles, of a few other major figures in the Eisenhower administration. But really, since this, the story I tell in More Than a Doctrine is really a story of, you know, presidential rhetoric to the American public, you know, that project doesn't necessarily lend itself well to interviews in the present. Although, you know, I did look at a few letters and feedback that the White House received from the public during this time.
Okay. What part of the research was most enjoyable?
Oh, yeah, I think... I really enjoyed looking through the campaign papers, actually. So, one fun thing about, presidential rhetoric is that, really until FDR, there's kind of this debate going on as to whether, the president owns his or her, or I guess his public statements, or whether that's the property of the public. And so Eisenhower is really one of the first presidents where it's all put in Abilene, Kansas, where you know, all the documents are there, but as a result of that, all the campaign speeches, the transcripts only survive there. And so they're not available digitally, they're not available anywhere else. And so I really enjoyed, you know, of course I was doing this research leading up to the 2016 presidential election, you know, hearing all these, you know, different debates going on and then checking it against what was said, you know, in 1952 and 1955, 1956. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was really interesting personally, but I enjoyed all parts of it. It was really fun looking at declassified documents. That's always a bit of a thrill.
Mm-hmm. What was the most difficult issue to research?
I would say the most difficult part of the project was really getting a grasp on what the American people thought of what Eisenhower was saying, and what they thought about how they responded to a lot of these, you know, arguments that he's putting out there. You know, opinion polls were helpful, so I draw from those, throughout the book and sort of say this is what's going on. And really my argument isn't so much about the American people, you know, voted yes for this policy or voted no for this policy. It's really more about the development of these argument fields, that then exist and can get drawn upon for future, you know, invention by presidential rhetors who want to persuade the public of certain things. But it was a bit difficult coming across really hard. You know, this is what people thought. This is how they responded. And so I relied a lot on, you know, newspaper archives, but that can only get you so far.
Mm-hmm. Was there anything you discovered that, had an emotional impact on you, either positively or negatively?
Yeah. This was a fulfilling project for me. I think, as I mentioned, you know, I was in Jordan, 2013, 2014, and a little after, teaching English. And so for me, I was, whenever, you know, I'm from West Texas, not a world traveler much until that point. And so for me, I was kind of shocked by this, you know, the predominance of foreigners and lots of people in Amman, Jordan. You know, while I was there, it was about the time Egypt was going through its recent troubles, and Syria obviously is an ongoing issue. And so if you wanted to learn Arabic, you went to Amman, Jordan, while I was there. And so I thought it was really interesting for me personally, thinking through, the politics of, you know, sending Americans abroad and where we're welcome, where it's normal for us to go and not. And so looking at the Eisenhower era, I thought it was really interesting to see, sort of the origins, of our current perceptions of the Middle East being developed, as this place where, you know, of course America is an insider to this region. We belong there. We're an established player. It's a region that we have a lot of interest in. And so of course it makes sense. That we would send people there to learn the language. So that was very fulfilling for me. But generally speaking, there wasn't anything that, you know, elicited a shocked gasp in the archive.
Mm-hmm. So what do you hope the book will do? What impact will it have?
Yeah, so I think, you know, any academic always, you know, crosses their fingers when they're saying something like this. But you know, I would really like that whoever reads it to have a much better grasp of why our current arguments and political discourse about the Middle East is as muddled as it is. I think the book could really help shed light on how we got to where we are, and it might help us say, you know, if this is how things began, how should that impact how we think of our rhetoric surrounding the region now? And if nothing else, hopefully we can have a more informed debate.
Did you have any difficulties getting the book published?
No. So I talked to University of Nebraska Press. They were very generous. They were the first people I spoke to, and they bit. So they were happy to publish the book, and it's under the Potomac imprint, which is fortuitous since I now live in the Washington, D.C. area.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't have any problems eliciting interest. And you know, my former graduate advisor, Martin J. Medhurst, who literally wrote the book on President Eisenhower's rhetoric and a lot of the rhetoric of the Cold War. He's produced a lot of the scholarship on that. He was generous and wrote a foreword to the book as well.
Mm-hmm. So I see it's published this month. Is it published now, or is it about to come out?
It's come out. So you can order it on University of Nebraska Press's website. Mm-hmm. Or on Amazon or other places good books are sold. So it should be available now, and I think it's for a very reasonable price considering it's an academic book.
Mm-hmm. So you didn't mention what your next writing project is.
So right now I am interested in the later Cold War in the Middle East. So my current projects center around that. I think I mentioned earlier a little bit about arms transfers, and so I'm looking at that. I'm looking at really how did Reagan set the table for the Gulf War and the War on Terror more generally during the late Cold War. So that's where my attention is right now regarding the Reagan Doctrine in the Middle East, and we'll see where that goes.
All right. Well, I don't have any more questions. Do you have any final words or thoughts?
No, I think I'm good. Thank you for this interview. You've been a great interviewer, and I'm glad to be on the show.
Yeah, all right. Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening. If you like this podcast, please like or follow me on Facebook under warscholar.org, on Twitter under warscholar, on Instagram under Chris Alvarez War Scholar, on YouTube under War Scholar 1945. More information can be found at warscholar.org. Thank you.